Bob. We good to go? Doesn't seem to be on.
Give me one second.
Well, I can say loudly enough. Oh, yeah, there it goes. Thank you to Larry and Chris for inviting me to participate in the event. In addition to all the anger and concern that the recent pay package have generated, they've also generated some really good research, and I feel like I learned a lot from reading the other two papers submitted by Jesse and Alex. And in broad terms, I agree with what they propose to do. I say that as a preamble because I'm going to suggest that even if we did all those things, most of what's stimulated people's concerns would remain, and there would still be important steps left to take. Jesse mentioned that people were outraged by the pay practices. Some of the ones I heard, that sounds like the right emotion to feel when you hear about that. I wrote a book more than 20 years ago about the strategic role of emotion in economic and social behavior. I argued in that book that anger is a very important emotion, that without it we couldn't function nearly as well in the kinds of strategic interactions we find ourselves in. But it's also important, I think, to be angry at the right people. I try to tell my students that in addition to recognizing that anger is important, it's also really important that when you get angry, to get angry at the right people. If you get angry at the wrong people, anger is not only not useful, it's counterproductive. So the analysis of how markets play out in situations like the ones we're talking about here is often very different in terms of the culprits that you decide at the end of the day deserve extra scrutiny. The usual targets sometimes aren't the right ones. Let me mention, I don't know if I can work this from here. Is it the top button?
Left and right. This is not our technical day, is it?
I'll go up.
No, don't worry about it.
I'll tell you to switch and you'll switch. I don't know if that's going to work. So the biologists have an interesting example. So when a new lion ascends to the alpha male position, the first thing he does is to kill all the cubs sired by the previous alpha male. The reason he does that, they explain, is that that brings the females into estrus more quickly and results in the transmission of more of his genes into the next generation. The lionesses are not involved caring for these cubs that were sired by others. They care for his cubs anew. Is that a bad thing? The biologist says that the question has no meaning. This is just what happens under competitive conditions in the wild. If there were ever a species of lions where this didn't happen and a mutant male entered the scene with a predisposition to behave in this way, it would sweep the population, and that's just what you end up with. There's not anything they can do about this. There's nobody who can make rules, nobody who can enforce another pattern of behavior. It's a bad pattern of behavior from the perspective of lions as a group. They invest many more resources sustaining themselves as a species because of this, but it's an equilibrium pattern. So if you think about the market for executive talent, I think there's a lot of similar impersonal market force explanation to what's been going on. That's David Skorton shown there. He was the candidate identified and then selected by Cornell's Presidential Search Committee a couple of years ago. I was involved in the process. We all knew at the time he was going to be in charge of the capital campaign. That was going to be job one for him. It was a $4 billion campaign. The kind of things you would want in a president also are good for running a capital campaign. He is incredibly warm and charming and outgoing. He's a distinguished research cardiologist. He's a professional clarinetist. The first time I met him, I saw him perform with the New Orleans Jazz Orchestra as a soloist. The alumni just want to write checks when he speaks. I've been in gatherings where he's spoken to alumni. You can just feel them reaching for the checkbooks. So $4 billion, he was clearly the best candidate we interviewed. What did that mean? I'm going to say a just noticeable difference. He had to be at least 3% better in prospect than the next best candidate. So you do the math, and that's a bottom line difference of $120 million. Now, not all in 1 year, but over 5 or 10 years, still a big sum. I was getting calls from reporters looking for an outraged quote from me, since I write about high-end pay. Had the boards of trustees lost their moral compass? What were they thinking to be writing checks like that? I don't think David Scorton gets even $1 million, but many presidents of universities do, and so that was kind of the outrage du jour. But if you think about it, how could the pay not be that high if there's any semblance of competition? If Princeton said, we'll give you $2 million, he wouldn't be embarrassed if he said, well, I owe it to my family to provide him the security. I've got to go there. So sooner or later, pay is going to track at least some semblance of productivity. And so when you see in the executive suite something similar here, I've got an even bigger number than Alex had. I think partly it's because I picked an earlier year, and also the corporations are a smaller subset of larger corporations. But by any measure, the explosion has been just that in executive pay. The numbers are truly spectacular, how much the pay has grown. And it does seem obscene, certainly in one sense. Nobody needs that much to live on. If you look at the kind of stuff they buy with it, you know, it's easy to make a case that something's wildly amiss here. But who's at fault exactly? Smith talked about market imperfections. He wrote that people of the same trade seldom meet together even for merriment and diversion, but the conversation ends in a conspiracy against the public or in some contrivance to raise prices. I grew up hearing about interlocking directorates. I didn't know what they were, but they were important. This is not a new thing, this idea of self-dealing and getting favors from people who are obligated to you. In fact, I would argue that it's much less important now than it was historically. CalPERS, the private equity guys, they're all looking around for opportunities to buy undervalued companies. And if you got too many people managing their companies sloppily and doing self-dealing, they're vulnerable to take over now in a way that they weren't at one time. Phil Cook and I argued that there's been a spread of a market structure that we used to see mostly in entertainment and sports, where your reward depends not just on how well you perform in some absolute sense, but on how well you performed relative to other people who are doing similar things to you. Indeed, in every sphere, we've seen a similar pattern of earnings growth. People in the middle, not much growth. People at the bottom, a little bit of retreat relative to 20 or 30 years ago, but the small handful at the top of every group, college graduates, dentists, engineers, any group you name, the top people in that group have been wildly successful. It's not all double dealing. Competition, by every measure, is much more intense now than it used to be. The information revolution, falling trade barriers, the ability to sort of get there and exploit an opportunity quickly, there are just not protected enclaves the way there used to be in markets. And so the fact that CEO pay grew so much over this period of time is at least consistent with the idea that there's much more at stake in CEO decisions. So the same capital campaign that makes it important for Cornell to have a gifted fundraiser much more than in the past makes it important for somebody who's running a $10 billion bottom line company to have somebody make slightly better decisions than the next guy. And a slightly better decision applied to that big of a base gives you a huge difference in the bottom line. That's just the mathematical reality of the new situation, the executive suite. If you don't like that explanation, and there are reasons to be skeptical of it, you could ask, well, how come they didn't get paid so much in the old days when small increases in the quality of decisions mattered a lot too? So here's Alfred Sloan, who ran the General Motors Corporation. It was always a big corporation. A slightly better decision made a big difference then. He didn't get paid anything like what the people today get paid in comparative terms. And so there's more to the story than that. I think what you have to look for is not just that a slightly better decision adds a lot to the bottom line. That's a necessary condition. It's not sufficient. There also has to be open competition for the people in the market. And that we did not see in in the CEO market. We didn't see it in professional sports, indeed, until the mid-70s. There's Dave McNally and Andy Messersmith, the two who successfully challenged free agency restrictions in professional sports. It was not until those two won their suits that we saw the real increase in pay in professional baseball. The increase in leverage in professional baseball began two decades before that, when the game of the week became the big source of revenue in baseball. It used to be 25,000 fans watching the stadium. That was where the revenue came from. But then in the 50s, you had national television was the big source of revenue. And so if you'll track the pay of the baseball players, free agency, you see right then and there is when the uptick started, and then every time there's a new media contract, it's reflected in the value of salaries. Today, the average major league salary is over $3 million a year. That's all because of free agency, open competition for players, and a much bigger bottom line that good performance is responsible for. There was never an anti-free agent law in the executive suite. You could hire anybody you wanted, but people didn't. It was always the belief that you had to promote from within, because how would anybody know how to run the company unless he'd spent his whole career within the company coming up through the ranks? That idea gradually gave way. Here, the graph depicts the increase in the number of hires, about a 50% increase over this 20-year span, of people hired from outside the company. They took over as CEO with less than 3 years tenure with the company. In the old days, that very rarely happened. You had one or two candidates who were credible, and so it was really a matter of internal negotiation between the board and the top candidate chosen, and pay was really largely indeterminate. There was no reason you had to pay tens of millions to get the best performer, because there was really only one performer you were talking to. One pivotal event in this arena was when IBM decided to hire Louis Gerstner away from RJR Nabisco to try to turn the struggling computer giant around. The IBM company is a $10 billion earnings company. 1% improvement in performance of that company means $100 million a year. The stakes are very, very high. And their thought was that here's Gerstner. He doesn't know anything about mainframes, but we have tech people for that. He knows finance. He knows management. He knows how to motivate people. Maybe he can do for us what he did for them. And sure enough, he did do that. And so the lavish pay he got was worth it. So clearly, a good CEO is worth every penny and more. What about the bad CEOs? Why do they get paid so much? That seems to be a flaw in this argument. There's Roger Moore, Roger Smith, the subject of the Michael Moore, Roger and Me documentary. He ran General Motors for 11 lackluster years. They did pretty badly. He got a good salary, not today's salaries, but a good salary. Well, there's a going rate for every category of position. If you hire a CEO, you don't want to say, we're paying our guy $400,000 a year. He's a schlemiel, but that's about what we think he's worth. You hire the CEO with high hopes. You don't know what he's worth. You're hoping he's going to work out in the environment into which he's hired. But what's changed is that he doesn't stay 11 years if he doesn't work out the way Roger Smith did. Stemple came right after Smith. He stayed for about 18 months. He didn't deliver. He was out of there. And that's more of the rule. So you get hired. There's a going rate. The going rate's very high now because more is at stake in these decisions. And you get fired quickly if you don't deliver. That's the new executive contract. Okay, and I've got 2 minutes to explain to you why this matters. So if they're getting paid roughly in line with what they deliver, subject to all the obvious flaws in corporate governance that are still being ironed out, and you know, are there better contracts that we can work out? It matters because we need a lot of revenue to do important things, and the consumption standard set by people at the top has given rise to an expenditure pattern that's been incredibly wasteful of resources in the United States and has caused a lot of pain for families in the middle and further down in the income ladder. So standard models think context doesn't matter at all. They say utility depends on absolute consumption. We'll look back 100 years from now and wonder how on earth a profession could have clung to that idea for any length of time. Context is decisive in your decisions about what you want and need. And so if we think about expenditure patterns, they've changed dramatically. The people in the middle don't have any more money than they used to, but they're spending a lot more than they used to spend. Why are they? Because people at the top are spending more. Why are they spending more? Because they have more money. People at the next level down associate with people at the top, and that shifts the frame of reference for them. They spend more, and you get a cascade all the way down the income ladder. Why that matters is that it really ups the price of your achieving basic goals that you're trying to achieve. Can we flip, Christian? So if you want to send your kid to a good school, that means you've got to spend as much as other people do on a house. The good schools are in the expensive neighborhoods. And so if others are spending more on housing, and you're not, then your kids go to the bad school. So, of course, you're going to try and match people's spending on houses because that's the price of admission to a good school. The problem is, because of the expenditure cascade, you've got to cough up more than 50% more to buy the median house now than you did 20 years ago. So, and that's why if we look at the data in the which Adam Seth Levine and Wiga Dyke and I have done, for the most populous U.S. counties where income inequality grew the most between 1990 and 2000, we saw the biggest growth in bankruptcy rates, the biggest growth in long commute times, the biggest growth in divorce rates. These are all symptoms of financial distress, and they correlate very strongly with increases in inequality. So inequality matters. Inequality is driven by explosive growth in top salaries. Trying to micromanage top salaries with caps and other devices that have been proposed, I think, is not a good idea. But what's clear is this. Executives would be happy to work for a tenth of today's salaries. And we have an instrument that would put them in that position. We have a tax structure that could, as in the old days, have graduated rates going much further up than the graduated rate structure does now. And if you think a CEO doesn't need $100 million a year to live, you're right. If you think that money could be spent on things that would do more for the CEO than the things he's spending it on, you're right there too. Because what we know is that for high-level consumption, it's all relative. A CEO needs 60,000 square feet mansion because other CEOs have one. If they all had a smaller mansion, they would all be happier, not less happy. It's a nuisance to have such a big mansion. If the only reason you need one is because you need to claim your spot in the social order, a tax that diverted some money to pay for things that matter to you. The I-35 bridge collapsed on the way into Minneapolis. Rich people fell into the Mississippi that day too. They gave tax cuts to rich people so they could build bigger mansions, and to balance the budget, they cut the Energy Department's budget for rounding up loose nuclear materials in the former Soviet Union, which are going to come to New York someday, where I've got two kids in school. That's not good for rich people to spend their money that way. It's not good for poor people or middle-class people. There are simple solutions. We could move to a better place. Sorry if I went over.
Okay, thank you.